Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of What's It Like, where we talk with folks about their own life experiences from all over the place. My typical disclaimer I want to toss up here at the top of the show. This is one person's story, one person's experience. Somebody else may go through the same thing and have a very different response to it or very different story to tell. And that is okay. That's wonderful. We are only here to hear one person's version of how what it was like for them. So today, I want to go ahead and welcome our guest. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Hi. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited you're on. So in like a sentence or two, give us like the elevator pitch of what's the experience you're going to teach our listeners or tell our listeners about today.
I'm a playwright and screenwriter. I work mostly in comedy. Lately, I've been integrating comedy with my own existential former evangelical Christianity stuff. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I write plays and screenplays. I specialize in dialogue, and I really just like making myself laugh. And so I just have been writing it down since I was 14 years old, and I just turned 25 the other day. So we're here to talk about that.
Yes, awesome. So let's start from the beginning. You've been doing this for a long time. Tell me about your relationship with theater overall and when playwriting really started rising up.
Yeah, you know, I think my entire life, and if you ask my parents about this, I've been entertaining from basically the moment I was born. I know they always talk about how youngest children are sort of the people who are on display in the family. Mm-hmm. And as a youngest child, I feel like that's really true, at least in my family. You have to learn how to talk to people older than you pretty quickly. Mm. And so really I've been entertaining my siblings' friends, my parents' friends, pretty much my entire life. And so then I got into theater in elementary school and middle school. And then there was just one time when I was in my eighth grade play and I had gotten a prominent role in the show. And I was flipping through the script, and honestly, this play was like a play written for children to perform, mm-hmm. i.e. it was not very good. And, you know, I was 14 years old. I was flipping through the script, and I said to my director, you know, Mrs. Fisher, I think I can write a better script than this. And I said this during rehearsal, you know, very arrogant 14-year-old white boy energy. And I said this, and she said, okay, I want to see you write a play. I think she said that to shut me up. Mm-hmm. But that summer, after we did the show, I went home and I wrote a play because I wanted to do it. So I took all the lessons I had had from the couple shows I'd been in and looked at those scripts and just started writing a story. And I ended up giving her that story somewhere in the middle of the summer. And she read it. And she said, hey, this is actually really good. I want to do this with the middle schoolers next year. And so I was heading into ninth grade. So she was directing the seventh and eighth graders in the show the following year. And it really didn't stop. I took a lengthy hiatus when I took a hard right-hand turn into evangelicalism, mm-hmm. in high school. But I really got back in touch with my roots when I was starting senior year of college, and I wrote another play, and then I've written two more since. So that's sort of how I got started.
Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about what was the experience like for that very first one, especially since we were not only wrote a play so young, but got the chance to actually see it performed. What was that like?
It was so trippy. Like, you know, I had spent so much time with this script, and I mean, I really owe the fact that this first play happened to my dad. I mean, my dad's not a writer or a theater person. Or my dad is a writer. He's just not really, he's not a theater person, but he edited every single scene that I wrote as I wrote it. And so, you know, we had just spent all this time together with the script. And then by November, I turned in the final version. Right. So this was draft 5.0 or whatever that we were doing. That was just kind of shaped into, okay, this is a play that we can actually have other people watch. And I owe large parts to my dad and the teacher to just helping me get there. But I really didn't think about it from November until April when the show premiered. And I had stopped in to one rehearsal to just introduce myself if they didn't know me already, because I basically knew everybody because they were, you know, my classmates. And then just sitting there in April, hearing the script out loud, being voiced and acted by people who were not my voice specifically, that was just like, I could recall every single thing that I wrote. And it was like, just like this weird otherworldly kind of feeling of hearing, oh yeah, this is a realization of what my original thought was. This is amazing. You know?
Oh, I love that. So yeah, so you wrote that initial play and then kind of came back to it as an adult. So especially in the three plays that you've written since that very first one, how has your process changed with each play? What has grown for you as a playwright?
You know, I think my biggest thing that has grown over the past 10 years is just my understanding of the medium. Because it is very important to have control over the medium that you're writing in and just have the confidence of, yeah, I know how to make this happen on a stage. And so just as time has gone on, I've gotten a better sense of, A, what professional theaters actually want, just in terms of some of the experience I've had working in professional theaters, but also just an idea of, okay, what am I actually writing for right now? Because before, I was always writing for schools. That was what the first two plays I wrote were for. And the thought was, okay, I got to get as many people up there on stage as possible. And the shift in that happened when I wrote and produced my third play. And I'd written that for a cast size of 10, and we cut it down to 8 because now we were playing with real money. And hiring 8 actors is not as expensive as hiring 10.
Exactly.
So, and then you go to my fourth play, which just premiered at the end of July over Zoom, and that's only 4. So it's just that's the most tangible example of having command of my medium, but just thinking about how do I actually make this happen while I'm writing it? Yeah, it's just an awareness of this is a thing, this is like a recipe that someone's going to have to follow to put this together. And just being able to write it in such a way that it will be easy to produce.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process, which might still be evolving as always.
Right.
How long do these take you to write? Do you focus on one at a time? Do you intersperse it with readings? What are you finding to work for you?
You know, I would say the first draft takes about 6 weeks once I actually sit down. Right. So I would say there's like a gestation period for an idea, and that can be anywhere from 1.5 years, 2 years, to just a couple months. But as the idea develops, then I get to a point where I say, okay, I'm ready to start writing this. That takes about 6 weeks.
Okay.
To get from first word to end scene. At the end of the end of the script. But in terms of the script evolving, I mean, shoot, I'm still working on 2 of them, you know? Like, I would say, like, the process from first draft to publication on my first 2 plays that are now published. So the play that I wrote when I was 14 is now published. And so is the one I wrote my senior year at Wheaton. And so the first draft to publication for that, for the first play, was about 10 years of iterating on it and improving it and getting to a point where it doesn't feel like it was written by a 14-year-old, you know? And the second play was, you know, about 3 years from initial to publication. And the answer is it varies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that makes total sense. As you continue on, you talked about really liking comedy and connecting with existential search for meaning coming out of your former evangelical background. Would you say that those are primary themes that you really are drawn to? Are there other ones that tend to pop up around your work?
Oh, absolutely. I think I really admire Mike Shore. Do you know who Mike Shore is?
Television, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Good Place, and The Office. Yeah.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place, The Office, Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
Those are all shows where it's comedy that believes in the ultimate goodness of humanity. Mm. I don't like mean-spirited comedy. There's nothing about that appeals to me. I don't like seeing people be cruel to each other. Unless it's, you know, an antagonist interacting with a protagonist. But, you know, I like to write works that make people laugh and make them think. Mm. So, and I mean, you see that most with this most recent show that I wrote. But my primary goal is to make people enjoy the time that they have, that they spend with the show, and leave them wanting to be better people than they were. Because, I mean, that's kind of what I try to do as a human being and the way that I interact with people. And these scripts that I've written are sort of extensions of that, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I'd like to touch on specifically. I know that I watched the Zoom or watched the recording of Peter's last play over Zoom, which is available, and that one in particular. I'd love to talk a little bit about the fact that this play is all, it's about the afterlife. It features a very young evangelical character. I'd love to hear about how, I watch these plays, and for me, and I suspect sometimes for writers who are writing on similar topics, there's a little bit of metaphorical exercising of demons of the past I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, about how taking this character who, from what I've been hearing you talk about, is not dissimilar from your own past.
Right.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that process, either in this play or in future plays or anything else that you've done.
Oh, for sure. So let's talk about Abandon All Hope.
Yeah.
So Abandon All Hope, if to the listener at home, that's available on YouTube. Just search Abandon All Hope by Peter Fenton. It is a 2-hour investment. So, you know, get a drink or make a snack. Yeah. It's a good time. I play Evan Daigle, who, like, Evan, the first four letters of the word evangelical is Evan. So he really represents who I was when I was a freshman in college. So I'm an alum of Wheaton College, and that is famously the school where Billy Graham went and John Piper, John the Diaper Piper. And it's also where Rob Bell went. And I'm much more on the Rob Bell side of Wheaton College than those other two. It's implied. What was the question? You said there was...
You were giving us your character, Evan, is very much this kind of character.
Yeah. And so it was so cathartic, honestly, writing and playing him. It was... just the ability to get all of those things out on the page that I used to think, that I used to believe. And like, I really don't think that evangelicals are evil inherently. Mm-hmm. I think they are some of the most well-meaning people in the world. And I also think very much that evangelical Christians do a very good job of backing up what it is they believe in. Mm-hmm. And like when they say they're going to do something, I do believe that they're going to do it more often than not, mm-hmm. which is something that is very admirable. And I wrote each of these three humans who are in what they're told is hell in Abandon All Hope as people who have the potential to really, really, really do good, but there's something that's holding them back significantly. And what I chalk Evan up to is he holds on to dogma. He holds on to the Bible as interpreted by white American evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. And because that is really something that I clung to and something that it was a simple way to understand the world for me. And if everyone just followed these rules, it would be perfect, right? And, yeah. You know, things are complicated when you are a woman who's in leadership or a man who is gay, as I eventually learned about myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's white American evangelicalism works until you find something that makes it not work, which is actually quite a lot of things. Because we don't live in this black and white picture that American evangelicalism paints for us. And so I wanted to write something where I captured that, you know, the really, really well-meaning black and white thinker in evangelicalism who really does have the potential to do good if he were to just hold his claims a little looser and be able to listen to and learn from the people around him, like, and really believe that each person is made in the image of God, which I think is an issue that I definitely faced as a former evangelical. I definitely saw some people as less than, and therefore they weren't worth listening to and learning from.
No, I think that's really interesting, giving this character kind of the chance to represent who you were and looking back on that from where you are now. Sounds like it could be an incredibly rewarding process, but also incredibly difficult.
Oh, I cried. I cried so much when I wrote the play.
Oh.
You know, and I mean, I say that because I can laugh about it.
Yeah.
But there were, for the listener at home who may or may not end up watching or listening to the play, there comes a point where this Evan character is confronted with a close friend coming out to him. Mm. And it evolved a bit from the first draft to the second draft. He was a lot meaner in the first draft. Mm. But it was just in writing, pretty much everything that Evan says about gay people is something that has been said to me from my evangelical circles. And by the time I performed it, it was really cathartic. But writing it down on the page was a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that makes total sense. No, and I think there are not a lot of plays out there that are written by folks about this. You know, there are a lot of very loud evangelical voices who are saying the kinds of things that this character believes, the kinds of things that you believed. And I think that there are, for how loud those voices can be, I think there isn't enough theater right now that reacts to that from a place of understanding that. Sometimes stereotyped a lot in a way that doesn't ring true. And I really enjoyed as I was watching yours, I could tell that this was coming from a real
someone who did their homework.
It's like, oh goodness, yes. On a lighter note, I'd love to know about the Zoom reading process. I'm sure that was really different from sitting in a room. So talk to me about what was what worked well, what didn't, what would you do differently if you had to do another Zoom reading?
Well, of course, this was born out of COVID, right? There was, I mean, Broadway's not coming back until January 2021 at the earliest.
Yeah.
And so there was no real chance for me to try to mount a production of this show. So it was just trying to figure out how I can get this out there to people, because I really did believe, and it sounds like it at least resonated with you. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was going to resonate with a lot of people. Some of my test readers said, hey, I think this is really going to go somewhere. So I wanted to get that ball rolling. So I took a screenwriting seminar in the early days of COVID, in a much more innocent time of March, over Zoom with this producer, Tony. And so he was somebody who I got connected with through a guy I met at Q Christian Fellowship, the conference. Q Christian Fellowship is a body of LGBTQ Christians, and they have an annual conference. And so I flew down to Fort Lauderdale in January before the world fell apart.
Yeah.
And I met this pastor out in the Bay Area. And he said, I had known him from Twitter. So like it was an in-person meeting of a Twitter friend. It's so weird meeting someone over Twitter and then meeting them in real life. It was just like, wow, your voice is a lot higher than I thought it would be or whatever. That's never the case with me. Everyone always says, oh, wow, your voice is surprisingly low. But, you know, whatever. So I met this guy and he is co-pastors with a film producer. So he got me connected with this film producer who's an affirming progressive pastor. And so I took a class that he was leading and I got talking about my script because I was working on it at the time. And he said, this script sounds really interesting. Can I read it? And, you know, of course I said yes. And he said, hey, I really like this. This is a really great idea. Let's make this happen. I do all kinds of virtual panels through my company. Would you be interested in doing a virtual reading of your script? And so I decided, yeah. And I decided, let's make this a free event for anyone to watch.
Yeah.
I think getting the more people to hear the story and experience it, the better. Because I mean, no one has money right now, so it's not like I can really generate profit off of anything, but just getting the script out there, getting my words on people's radar, you know, I mean, what was there to lose? So I said, great. I said, can I play Evan? And he said, of course. So I cast myself in the role, and then between the two of us, we reached out to the other three that were in the cast. A friend of mine, Jeffrey, who ended up playing the role of Sean. I reached out to him because he was perfect for the part. Mm-hmm. And then Tony had cast the two women. And that was excellent. You know, going back, I mean, I don't have really any regrets about the way it went. I felt really good about it. I think it's a good time. And you know, it's a really easy watch. You know, I've had a couple people say I didn't intend to watch the entire 2 hours in one sitting, but here I am, you know.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, that's a really good sign. One thing that I think I would want to do, and I don't know if it's just me, like I'm the only one who noticed it as the writer, but I think we took about 30 minutes to really hit our stride as just being comfortable with each other, being comfortable with the platform, being comfortable with the script, because we didn't do this from any rehearsals. The only rehearsal we had was I did a FaceTime with Jeffrey the day before and we just ran through the entire script. So it was just very rough. It was just, okay, you don't talk for a while, let's skip a couple pages, you know.
Yeah,
but I do think all my actors read ahead of time. I know that. And, you know, I think it was a really good product. I feel great about it.
Good. Yeah, you should. It was, I really enjoyed watching it, and I'll definitely make sure and put the link in the show description as well, so any of our listeners can find it. I'd love to chat real quickly about what it was like to act in and direct your own work a little bit. How did that change your relationship with the text?
Yeah, you know, this was my very first time acting in one of my own plays. And, you know, I think part of it was out of necessity. Like, I thought that it would be a huge advantage to have the one person who's most familiar with the text to be one of the people acting it, mm-hmm. seeing as the rest of the cast did not have rehearsal.
Yeah.
So I definitely thought that on a practical level, but it was really fun. I didn't feel like I had to act that much. I just had to more step back in time to who I was when I was a freshman.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I read my preparation for the role. I didn't actually read the script that much to prepare for it. I went back and I read some of my papers from when I was a freshman at Wheaton, and just like the really awkward shoehorning in of Bible verses or the phrase the Lord, or, you know, it was classic. It was a walk down memory lane getting there. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like that. And who are some of the, especially as you talk about getting more familiar with the medium, who are some of the playwrights? You talked about Michael Schur. Are there other playwrights who you're really finding inspiration in these days?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't think as much I'm drawn to specific theater writers, but I am very much drawn to TV producers and screenwriters. Like, I'm very much drawn to the work of Mitch Hurwitz. Mm-hmm. He created Arrested Development.
Yeah.
I'm also, okay, this is going to be way out of left field, but I love the sense of humor in the Paper Mario series.
Okay.
Yeah, great games, and also Sticker Star. I love Paper Mario, The Thousand Year Door might be the reason I'm a writer.
Huh.
Right?
How yeah. so? Like, I don't know these games at all. How does that connect?
It's like, you know, the Mario series really isn't that witty or clever, but there's this side series of games where the graphics are like storybook art. Mm-hmm. And it's an RPG type of game, and they're just really text heavy and really witty. Like, it's kind of hard to describe unless you just look up cutscenes from this game. And it's just really clever and really like for the thinking kid. And, you know, I was really nerdy as a kid, so I really liked these games. And I think just that sort of like whimsical and also surprisingly dark games just really inspired my idea of what a good story is. And it's weird. I'll admit it's weird.
No, I think that's fantastic. I absolutely love the strange places inspiration comes from.
Like, the Paper Mario, The Thousand Year Door is this quest where Princess Peach, she wasn't kidnapped by Bowser. She was kidnapped by space Nazis.
Oh my.
And
okay.
And Mario's on this quest to find these seven crystals that are scattered around the land. And the space Nazis are also looking for these crystals. But we don't know until the end of the game that the crystals were actually created to resurrect this demon. And the demon needed a host. That's why the space Nazis kidnapped Princess Peach. So the final boss battle of this game is Mario fighting possessed Peach. It's like, and the game's hilarious. Like, it's the best video game ever made. I'm going to stake my claim on that.
That's amazing. I am going to have to find out more about this.
Nintendo GameCube from 2004.
That is fascinating. Now I'm curious. So you get your writing inspiration from a lot of TV and film. How does that translate to you through to theater, which is a different medium? So what are some of the things that you've had that you feel like you have brought with you from film and TV, observing and learning, and translated into theater? Or are they very similar for you?
You know, I think I'm a dialogue writer. Mm. That's what it comes back to. You know, I would love to write a novel, but I can't. At least at this point, I can't. You know, I don't really care to describe how things look. Mm-hmm. I care to describe how things sound. And not even describe, I tell you how it sounds. Right? So, I mean, podcasting is a great medium. Yeah. So film and TV, film, TV, theater, they're all very much, for me as the writer, I think about how it sounds.
Yeah.
Right? And the jokes that are spoken out loud. Now, I mean, visual jokes are very funny, but that's not my specialty.
Yeah.
You know? So when I'm writing, another creator that I really like is Aaron Sorkin. He did The West Wing.
I was going to say, if you like dialogue, you got to like Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. And so I think the one thing that I often have to cut down on is just how much talking there is, which is actually why theater is a better medium for me than film.
Yeah.
Because film is the director and the director of photography's medium. I love film. I've worked on a couple films. But that's very much, the writer is secondary there. Like, the writer's not the one who's driving the scene as much.
Yeah.
But in a play, the writer is. And you're hearing these words that the writer's written, and you're making something out of it, right? And the script that you hand a film director or a TV director is, here's an idea of how this could go, but we'll see how this looks on set.
Yeah.
And we'll change accordingly, which is great. And I think that's good. And I've written a couple screenplays, and I've worked as an assistant director on a film. And I very much see the value of it. But as a writer, I feel much more comfortable on the stage because the dialogue is what carries the show.
Yeah.
You're not cutting to different things necessarily. It's just, there's a room and you don't leave it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, criticism that gets levied sometimes at film or TV that is very talky is that it feels too much like a play. So if the talkiness is what you love, it makes sense that theater would be a good medium for that.
Right. And I mean, of course, I always have to, keep that in mind as I'm doing my edits that, this seems going on a little long, or we definitely got the point of this line 5 sentences ago, you know. Like that sort of thing. And I mean, that's what I'm doing right now as I'm editing Abandon All Hope and getting it to draft 3, you know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to cut it down. I think there's about 20 to 30 minutes of dead space that I can cut and still tell the exact same story, but just be more effective because it's less muddied.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That brings me actually to my last real question before we wrap things up.
Sure.
What's next for you? Do you have seeds for the next one to grow?
You know, I have play number 5 in mind, and it's in sort of that idea gestation period, like we talked about earlier. So I don't know how long that gestation period is going to be. Maybe as I'm getting older and more established in my career, that gestation period is shorter, right?
Yeah.
But right now in my theater career, I am really trying to find a home for Abandon All Hope.
Yeah.
I do think that we need to find an honest to God production for this show.
Yeah.
Because I think there's only so much you can do on a Zoom reading.
Mm-hmm.
And given the play is set in one room and these people are all interacting with each other and driving each other insane, you kind of need to see that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what I've been doing is I've been putting together a pitch deck. Are you familiar with a pitch deck? Would the listeners be familiar with?
I am a bit, but our listeners probably won't.
Okay. Yeah. So a pitch deck is essentially, I call it like the Pinterest board for your show. It's a document that will succinctly communicate your tone, your style, your characters, your story, without handing a producer or agent your 100-page script, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a very visual document, which I've been working on it basically for the past month. And it's a shorthand. It's flipping through this document will give you a sense of what's this play all about, what's the thought behind it, what's going to happen in this. And you also got to make it look like you want the show to look. So, for example, the pitch packet that I based mine on, like my example that I was given was the pitch deck for Stranger Things.
Okay.
And they made it look like a Stephen King book.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the cover looked like a frayed 80s novel. Mm-hmm. And it was unmistakably like one of those books that was in my second grade teacher's classroom. Well, maybe yes. Not second grade teacher's classroom, because Stephen King probably isn't.
That's an adventurous second grade.
Right. Yeah. I don't even remember what her name was, but that's not important. So that's what the Stranger Things book looks like. It looks like a Stephen King novel. So what I decided to do was I wanted to make it look like a hardcover journal for Abandon All Hope, because it's set.
Okay, yeah.
It's set in hell, but hell looks like a college dorm room. So I wanted to convey that, like, this was a college notebook that someone had.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it look like there was blood splatter.
Yeah.
on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And then throughout, as you flip through the document, the pages of actual text look like lined notebook paper. And the headings are done in a handwriting font, a classy handwriting font, none of that Comic Sans or whatever. And then, so it looks like actual notes that have been taken. And then I show a lot of photos. I show photos of my own dorm room at Wheaton. I show a picture of myself as a freshman at Wheaton.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really is important and it's personal.
Yeah.
And I have to communicate that, hey, this is a reflection of my story being in a college dorm room, feeling like that dorm room was like a pressure cooker for me.
Yeah.
Where all my insecurities were being tossed into this pressure cooker with no way out, right?
Yeah.
So I do that, and then I do some character descriptions. I talk about the underlying philosophy of the script, and I say, you know, this play is informed by my own faith, and I am a former evangelical, but I'm much more of a Rachel Held Evans type of Christian now. And it's just being able to pull out buzzwords like that, like saying Rachel Held Evans, rest in peace, that means something to progressive Christian audiences.
Yeah.
And so I'm identifying that this is the audience for this show. And yeah, you know, so that's what I've been working on the past month, getting all that together. And I think it's finally at a place where I can start getting some professional feedback on it. You know, I've had my parents look at it, but they're not showbiz people. They're wonderful. Yeah. They're not showbiz people.
No, absolutely. I think I hope that goes really well. I'm interested to hear, the next steps for this particular play, and hopefully some of our listeners will fall in love with the play as well and want to track its journey forward.
I hope so too. It's going to be a fun one.
Yeah. Okay. So as we kind of wrap things up, I mentioned before the podcast started, this is likely going out to two sets of audiences. One who maybe have some experience in this, maybe, but or think they might, maybe thinking about writing a play. And then others who will never do this and know they'll never do this. So I would love to hear maybe some advice for somebody who is maybe getting ready to write their first play, or they have that seed rolling around their heads. And then as well, somebody who's never going to write a play ever, what would you like them to know about the process?
Sure.
Maybe gets missed. So speaking
to these people. Yeah. And I think my advice would be pretty similar for both. I would say the first draft, it doesn't matter that it's right. It matters that it happens. Mm. You have literally forever to, or I mean, however long you're going to live, to make your project better. But it is so much easier to work from something that exists than making something perfect out of nothing. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
The first draft of Abandon All Hope was awful. It was bad. Like, and I feel comfortable saying that. Like, I'm frankly surprised that my second draft, which was the one that we read out loud, was usable.
Mm-hmm.
But it really didn't matter that it was perfect. You just had to get it out on the page.
Yeah.
And finishing the first draft means you can set it down for a little bit, walk away from it, feel good about that first draft you made, but then go back into it and be ready to change it, be ready to find what didn't work and find how you're going to do better in the second draft. And I really think that applies to pretty much any project you do in life, whether or not it's writing. I think a lot of times when we do something for the first time, it's not very good. But what matters is that you did it. And if you want to do it again, you want to do it better, you want to do it perfect. I mean, it's never going to be perfect, but you want to get it more perfect than it was. You got to look at what you did and see how you can change it and make it better.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So before we close out, was there anything about this process that you wanted to make sure? We'll give you a second to share your website and whatnot in a second. But is there anything about the writing a play process that you wanted to make sure that we got to that we didn't yet?
You know, I think we covered pretty much everything.
Awesome.
I think you asked a really comprehensive set of questions. And of course, I mean, my DMs are open if any listeners want to ask me questions about what the experience is like, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get to that. Where can listeners find you?
Sure. I am on Facebook. You can add me as a friend. I mean, as long as you're not a spam account, I accept pretty much all friend requests. I'm Peter Fenton. That's Fenton. And you can find my website at www.bypeterfenton.com. So that's B-Y, not B-I, because I'm gay. It's bypeterfenton.com. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, both at Peter Fent. So just start typing my name, but stop. Because if you type out Peter Fenton, you get some, like, Silicon Valley executive, and that's definitely not me.
I was trying to find your website, and I just kept finding this venture capitalist. And I was like, that's not helpful.
Yeah, it's so funny, because... That's not me.
It could have been, but no.
Could have been.
No. This is awesome. I'll make sure and put all those links in the show description as well so that folks can find you. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this experience with everybody.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Hannah. This was great.
Awesome. All right, folks, that is our episode. I'll be back next week, and you can come back and hear somebody else share a completely different experience. So we will see you then.